From the prosecutor's table, you focus on the jurors. Nico is whispering. It seems to be something like, "Where the hell is the stuff?" A couple of the jury members respond alertly to this part of the examination. Stern is about to sit down when I ask him to bring the photos over. Sandy casts me a black look. This is proof that Stern would just as soon be forgotten. I motion to him again, however, and he hands me the stack. I finally find the picture of the bar and make my point to Stern. He bows briefly to me before returning to the witness. "You identified this photograph, Detective Greer. State Exhibit 6G?"
"Yes, sir."
"It reflects the bar where you found this glass?"
"It does."
"Tell me, sir, this would be easier if we had the glass, but is your recollection of it good?"
"I think so. It's like the ones in the picture."
"Just so. The glass you seized was one of this set of barware laid out here on this towel?"
Sandy has turned the photograph around so both Greer and the jurors can see the portion of the picture Stern means to indicate.
"Right. Count the glasses, would you?"
Greer lays his finger on the photo and does it slowly.
12, he says.
12, Stern repeats. "So the missing glass would make 13?
Greer knows this is peculiar. He waggles his head.
"I guess so."
"An odd set?"
Molto objects, but Greer answers "very" before Laren can rule.
"Really," Sandy says to me when we break for lunch, "I appreciate your thoughts, Rusty, but you must share them with us before the last moment. This detail may be significant."
I look at Stern as we are heading out of court. "I just noticed," I tell him. The prosecutors have a dismal afternoon. I never tried a case as a deputy PA that did not have a low spot, a trough, a place where my evidence was weak. I used to talk about walking through the valley of death. For Nico, as we've long known, the valley is trying to prove what went on between Carolyn and me. His hope, quite clearly, is to get just enough evidence before the jury that they can make a comfortable guess. The overall plan Molto and he seemingly made was to start strong with Greer, stagger through this portion, and then dash for home, with the physical evidence providing a note of rising credibility. A reasonable strategy. But all the lawyers come to court after lunch, knowing that these hours will belong to the defense. The state's next witness is Eugenia Martinez, my former secretary. She clearly sees this as her moment. She comes to the stand in a broad slouch hat and dangling earrings. Nico presents her testimony, which is succinct. Eugenia testifies that she has been employed in the PA's office 15 years. For 2 of those 15 years, ending last April, she worked for me. One day, last September or October, in answering the phone, Eugenia picked up the wrong line. She heard just a few words of conversation, but she recognized the voices as those of Ms. Polhemus and me. I was talking about meeting Ms. Polhemus at her home.
"And how did they sound to you?" asks Nico. "Object to sound," says Stern. "It calls for a characterization."
"Sustained?" Nico faces Laren.
"Judge, she can testify to what she heard."
"What she heard, but no opinions."
From the bench, Laren addresses Eugenia. "Ms. Martinez, you cannot tell us what you thought when you heard the conversation, just the words and the intonation."
"What was the intonation?"
Nico asks, back close to where he wanted to be. Eugenia, however, is not ready for the question.
"Nice like,"
she finally answers. Stern objects, but the response is too innocuous to merit exclusion. Laren flips a hand and says that the answer may stand. Nico is having a difficult time with something important. Again, I am struck by how difficult it has been for him to prepare.
"Did they sound intimate?"
he asks.
"Objection!"
Stern shoots to his feet. The question is leading and unfairly suggestive. Laren again takes off on Nico before the jury. "The question was clearly improper," Laren says. "It is stricken, and the jurors are ordered to disregard it." But there is method to Nico's breach. He was trying to find some way to signal Eugenia. He asks,
"Could you further describe the tone of the remarks you heard?"
Stern objects again with force. The question has been previously asked and answered.
Laren peers down. Mr. DeLay, Guardia, I suggest that you move on.
Suddenly help comes to Nico from an unexpected source.
He say, my angel,
Eugenia volunteers. Nico faces her, stunned.
That's what he say, okay? He say he be coming at 8 o'clock and call her my angel.
For the first time since the trial began, my composure fails before the jury. I let out a sound. My look, I'm certain, is inflamed. Kemp lays a hand on mine.
My angel, I whisper, for Christ's sake.
Over his shoulder, Stern looks at me severely. Suddenly, ahead of where he expected to be, Nico sits down.
Cross-examination.
Sandy advances on Eugenia. He speaks as soon as he reaches his feet, not waiting to arrive at the podium. He has maintained the same scolding expression which only seconds ago he turned on me.
For whom do you work now in the prosecuting attorney's office, Ms. Martinez?
Work?
Whose typing do you do? Whose phones do you answer?
Mr. Molto.
This gentleman? The prosecutor at the table?
Eugenia says yes.
When Mr. Savage was forced to take leave because of this investigation, Mr. Molto advanced to Mr. Savage's position, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And that position is one of considerable authority and influence in the PA's office, is that right?
Number two man,
answers Eugenia.
And Mr. Molto was in charge of the investigation that brought him Mr. Savage's job?
Objection!
Your Honor,
Sandy says to the judge,
I am entitled to develop bias. The woman is testifying before her employer. Her perception of his motives is important.
Laren smiles. Stern is developing more than that, but his excuse will pass. The objection is overruled. The court reporter rereads the question, and Eugenia answers yes. Sandy, in his opening, touched only lightly on the election and the change of administration. This is his first attempt to develop rivalry for power as a theme. It will answer, in part, his question to the jury in his opening statement about why the prosecutors might move ahead on an insufficient case. It had never struck me that he might do that by picking on Molto rather than DeLaGuardia.
Now, in the course of investigating Mr. Savage, did Mr. Molto ask you to speak to a police officer about what you remembered of Mr. Savage's relationship with Ms. Polhemus?
Sir,
didn't you speak in May to Officer Glendenning?
Tom is in and out of court, but right now he is here, and Sandy points at him, seated in uniform at the prosecutor's table.
Yes, sir.
And you knew that the investigation was a very important one, particularly to your boss, Mr. Molto, did you not?
Seemed like.
And yet, madam, when you were asked about Mr. Savage's relationship with Ms. Polhemus, you never told Officer Glendenning that you heard Mr. Savage call Ms. Polhemus my angel, did you?
Sandy says it with a special cold emphasis. He appears furious with the perjury. He has Glendenning's report in his hand. Eugenia suddenly recognizes that she is trapped. She gets a slow, unwilling look and sags a little. She probably had no idea that the defense would know what she said before.
No, sir, she says.
You didn't tell Officer Glendenning that you recalled Mr. Savage using any term of endearment. Did you, madam?
No, sir.
She is brooding. I have seen this look 100 times. Her eyes close, her shoulders draw around her. This is when Eugenia is at her meanest.
I never said anything like that.
Not to Mr. Glendenning?
No time.
Sandy, before I do, recognizes where Eugenia is going. She has thought of a way out. He walks a few steps toward her.
Didn't you testify 5 minutes ago, madam, that Mr. Savage called Ms. Polhemus my angel?
Eugenia draws herself up in the witness stand, fierce and proud.
No way,
she says loudly. 3 or 4 of the jurors look away. One of them, the man who is learning about hamburgers, laughs out loud, just one little hiccup. Sandy studies Eugenia.
I see, he finally says. Well, tell me, Ms. Martinez, when you answer Mr. Molto's phone these days, do you listen in on his conversations?
Her thick eyes go sidelong with contempt. Nope, she says.
You would not listen a moment longer than you had to in order to recognize that someone is on the line. Is that not correct?
This, of course, is Eugenia's problem. She probably heard a good deal more pass on the telephone between Carolyn and me than she has disclosed. But even with the PA and his chief deputy prosecuting the case, she cannot admit to eavesdropping. The winds of fortune change too quickly, and Eugenia, a bureaucratic animal, knows that such an admission would eventually be the long-awaited dynamite to dislodge her from her sinecure in civil service concrete.
What you heard in an instant? That's all. No more? No, sir. And you tell us it was nice-like? Were those not your words? What I say, yes, sir.
Stern comes and stands beside Eugenia. She weighs about 200 pounds. She is broad-featured and surly, and even dressed in her finest, as she is today, she still does not look very good. Her dress is much too loud and is stretched tight over her bulk.
You base this answer, he asks, on your experience in such things?
Sandy is poker-faced, but a couple of the jurors get it. They look down as they smile. Eugenia certainly gets it. Killer's eyes do not grow colder. Stern does not ask for an answer.
And this conversation about meeting at Ms. Polhemus's apartment took place last September, you say? Yes, sir. Do you remember that Mr. Savage and Ms. Polhemus tried a case together as co-prosecutors last September?
Eugenia stops.
Uh-uh,
she says.
You do not remember the MacGaffin case? A child, a little boy, had been hideously tortured by his mother. His head put in a vice, his anus burned with cigarettes. You do not remember Mr. Savage securing the conviction of this?
Stern makes it look as if he is searching for a word before he ends with, Woman?
Oh, that one,
she says.
I recall. The MacGaffin case, I take it, was not recalled in your discussions with Mr. Molto?
Objection, Laren ponders.
I will withdraw it, says Stern.
He's made his point to the jury. Prosecutor Molto seems to be taking it in the shorts so far today. He has the tag for the missing glass. He has inspired Eugenia's perjury.
Miss Martinez, do you remember how warm it was in Kindle County last year around Labor Day?
Her brows close. She has taken enough of a beating that she is trying to cooperate.
Past 102 days. Correct, Stern says, improperly. Is the PA's office air-conditioned?
Eugenia snorts.
Only if you believe what they say.
Laughter throughout the courtroom. The judge, the jury, the spectators. Even Stern finally smiles.
I take it you try to leave as soon as the day ends when the heat is like that. You got that right.
But the prosecutors, when they are in the midst of a trial, do not leave at the end of the day, do they? She looks at Sandy suspiciously.
Isn't it commonplace in your experience for the deputy PAs to prepare for the next day of trial in the evenings?
Stern asks.
Oh, yes. Now, madam, would you not prefer to work in air conditioning rather than the PA's office on a very warm evening? Objection,
Nico says. It's largely pointless. I'll let it stand.
Sure would. You don't know of your own knowledge that Ms. Polhemus's apartment was air conditioned, I take it?
No, sir.
But you do know that the riverfront is much closer to the PA's office than Mr. Savage's home in Nearing.
Yes, sir.
Whatever the jury makes of Eugenia, it is probably favorable compared to their opinions of Mrs. Kropotnik, who is called next. Her few minutes on the witness stand achieve the level of pure burlesque. Mrs. Kropotnik is a widow. She does not say what Mr. Kropotnik died from, but it is hard to believe that Mrs. Kropotnik was not partly the cause. She is heavy-bosomed and garishly made up. Her hair is reddish, teased out so that it stands like a shrub, and her jewelry is thick. A difficult human being. She refuses to answer questions and narrates free flow. Mrs. Kropotnik explains as she is going along that the late Mr. Kropotnik was an entrepreneur of sorts. He bought their loft building on the riverfront when, as Mrs. K. puts it, the neighborhood was still a mess, with trucks and junk, whatever. She nods to the jury when she says this, confident that they know what she means. Mr. Kropotnik directed the refurbishment of the property himself.
He was a visionary. Do you know what I'm saying? He saw things. That place. You know what was in there? Tires. I'm not kidding, Mr. Diaguardi. Tires. Really. You could not believe the smell. I'm not squeamish, and it is embarrassing to say it, but one time he took me in there, I swear to God I thought I would retch.
Madam, Nico says, not for the first time,
he was a plumber. Who thought he knew real estate? Yes, Mr. Diaguardi.
She squints.
Is that your name? Diaguardi?
Della Guardia, says Nico, and casts his face despairingly toward Molto, seeking help. By and by, Mrs. Kropotnik reaches Carolyn. She was their tenant originally when she moved in almost a decade ago. During the conversion craze, the building went condo, and Carolyn bought. Listening to Mrs. Kropotnik, I write Kemp a note. Where does a probation officer going to law school at night get the money to rent on the waterfront? Kemp nods. He has thought of the same thing. For almost a decade, Carolyn lived on the second floor, and Mrs. Kropotnik the first. Carolyn sent flowers, not really the right thing, when Mr. Kropotnik died. Nico was eager to get Mrs. Kropotnik out of there. The lady is beyond control. He does not bother asking about the night Carolyn was murdered. Any identification Mrs. Kropotnik made at this point would be sorely impeached by her prior failures. Instead, Nico simply asks, "Do you see in the courtroom, Mrs. Kropotnik, anyone you have seen in the vicinity of Ms. Polhemus's apartment?"
"Well, I know I seen that one,"
she says. She throws both hands and her bangle bracelets in the direction of the judge. Laren covers his face with both hands. Nico pinches the bridge of his nose. The laughter in the spectator sections is suppressed, but seems after an instant to grow. Mrs. Kropotnik, recognizing that she has blown it, looks about desperately. She points at Tommy Molto, seated at the prosecutor's table.
"Him too,"
she says. Molto makes matters worse by turning to see if there is anyone behind him. By now the jurors are laughing. Nico retreats to the evidence cart and brings Mrs. Kropotnik the photo spread from which she has previously identified a snap of me. She looks at the spread, glances up in my direction, and shrugs. Who knows?
"Do you recall previously identifying photograph number 4? Nico asks.
This time she says it out loud.
"Who knows?"
When Nico closes his eyes in frustration, she adds,
"Oh, all right, I said it was him."
Nico heads for his seat.
Cross-examination.
"One question," says Stern. "Mrs. Kropotnik, I take it your building is air-conditioned?"
"Air-conditioned?" She turns to the judge. "What's his business if we got air condition?"
Laren stands to his full height and places his hands on the far side of the bench, so he is canted over Mrs. Kropotnik, 5 or 6 feet above her head.
"Mrs. Kropotnik," he says quietly, "that question can be answered yes or no. If you say anything else, I will hold you in contempt."
"Yes," says Mrs. Kropotnik. "Nothing further," says Stern. "Your Honor, the record will reflect that there was no identification of Mr. Savage?"
"The record will reflect," says Judge Little, shaking his head, "that Mr. Savage was one of the few persons in the courtroom Mrs. Kropotnik missed."
Laren leaves the bench with the laughter still ringing. Afterward, the reporters crowd around Stern. They want a comment from him on the first day's testimony, but he will make none. Kemp is packing back into Sandy's large trial case the documents, duplicates of statements and exhibits, that we withdrew during the day and which now litter the table. I am helping, but Stern takes my elbow and steers me toward the corridor.
"No gloating," he says. "We have a long night's work.
Tomorrow they will be calling Raymond Horgan. How familiar it all seems. I come home at night with the same laborer's weariness that has always followed a day in court. My bones feel hollowed out by the high-voltage impulse of the day. My muscles have a neuralgic tenderness from the adrenalized superheating. My pores, it seems, do not close down rapidly, and the low-toned body sweat of high excitement continues through the evening. I return home with my shirt encasing me like a package wrapper. Sitting in court, I actually forget at certain moments who is on trial. The performance aspect is, of course, not present, but the premium on close attention is large. And once we get back to the office, I can be a lawyer again, attacking the books, making notes and memos. I was never short on intensity. When the bus pulls into Nearing shortly before 1 a.m. and I walk down the lighted and silent streets of this gentle town, the feelings are all known, and because they are known, safe. I am in a harbor. My anxiety is stanched. I am at peace. As I have for years, I stop by the door in a rocking chair and remove my shoes so that when I go upstairs I will not disturb Barbara, who by now must be asleep. The house is dark. I absorb the silence and finally alone reflect on the events of the day. And in this moment, stimulated perhaps by all the talk of her, or simply by the momentary feeling that I have at last receded to the better past, or even by an unconscious recollection of other stealthy re-entries to my home, I am startled as Carolyn rises before me. Rises as she rose for me that month or so when I thought I had found Nirvana, naked to the waist, her breasts high and spectacularly round, the nipples red, erect, and thick, her hair full of static from our bedroom romping, her sensuous mouth parted to offer some clever, salacious, stimulating remark. And again I am made almost without the power of movement by my own desire, so fierce, so hungry, so wanton. I do not care that it is mad or hopeless. I whisper her name in the dark. Full of shame and longing, I am like a piece of crystal trembling near the breaking pitch. Carolyn. Hopeless. Mad. And I cannot believe my own conviction, which is not really an idea, but instead that deep embedded thing, that rope of emotion, which is a wish that I could do it all again. 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 And then the ghost recedes. She folds into the air. I sit still, spine stiffened in my chair. I am breathing quickly. It will be hours now, I know, before I can sleep. I grope in the hall cabinet for something to drink. I should make my mind work over the meaning of this nighttime visitation, but I cannot. I have the sensation, as determined as the longing of only moments before, that it is all past. I sit in the rocking chair in my living room. For some strange reason, I feel better with my briefcase, and I place it in my lap. But its protection is incomplete. The wake of this intrusion leaves the currents of my emotions roily and disturbed. In the dark, I sit, and I can feel the force of the large personages of my life circling about me like the multiple moons of some far planet, each one exerting its own deep tidal impulses upon me. Barbara, Nat, both my parents. Oh, this cataclysm of love and attachment, and shame. I feel the rocking sway of all of it, and a moving sickness of regret. Desperately, desperately, I promise everyone, all of them, myself, the God in whom I do not believe, that if I survive this, I will do better. Better than I have. An urgent compact, as sincere and grave as any deathbed wish. I drink my drink. I sit here in the dark and wait for peace. Chapter 28. The first thing I notice as Raymond Horgan comes into the courtroom is that he has on the same suit he wore to bury Carolyn, a subtle blue serge. The added weight does not detract from his public bearing. You would describe him now as burly, and still, in the rolling way he walks, a person of stature. He and Laren exchange the same sage grin while Raymond is sworn. Seated, Horgan looks outward to assess the crowd in a composed, professional manner. He nods to Stern first, then his glance crosses mine and he acknowledges me. I do not move. I do not allow an eyelash to flutter. At this moment, I wish with all my heart that I may be acquitted, not for the general sake of freedom, but so that I can see the look on Raymond Horgan the first time he has to face me on the street. Here in the courtroom, awaiting Raymond's entry, there was more of that epic atmosphere, the extra amperage of a special moment, 400 people on edge, an urgent undertone in the courtroom murmur. Today, I notice, the press gallery is larger by a row and a half, and the journalistic first string is on hand, the anchor people and columnists. I have been surprised during the trial by the extent to which the reporters have been willing to honor Stern's injunctions to keep wide berth of me. Now that they have their file footage of me entering the courthouse, which they can show with each night's story on TV, Barbara and I are able to come and go in relative peace. Now and then someone, usually a journalist whom I have known for years, will stop me with a question in the hallway. I refer all matters to Stern. Last week I also encountered a freelance journalist from New York who says he is considering writing a book about the case. He believes it will make good reading. I declined his invitation to buy me dinner. I would be oblivious to the press were it not for the morning papers. I have stopped watching the accounts on TV. The summaries seem so inept that they make me furious, even when the errors favor me. But I cannot avoid the headlines, which I see on the paper-dispensing machines as we drive into the city. The two dailies seem to have sworn a feud to see which can take the lead in trashy tabloid coverage of the case. Nico's revelation in opening of Raymond's amours with Carolyn produced tasteless headlines for 2 days. P.A. Sex, the Herald blared, with all kinds of kickers and subheads. It is impossible that the jury does not view these headlines, too. They pledged during voir dire not to read the papers, but that is a promise few trial lawyers trust. In the jury box, at the moment, there is a considerable stirring. The jurors seem far more excited to see Raymond than was the case, for example, when they first glimpsed Nico during the voir dire. Then I noticed only a few of the prospective jury members leaning over to one another and nodding in Delay's direction. Horgan brings a greater aura to the courtroom. He has been well known for most of everybody's adult life. He is a celebrity. Delaguardia is a replacement. Perhaps the suggestion of fleshy intrigue Nico floated in opening also contributes to the high interest. It is clear, however, that as Stern weeks ago predicted, we have reached a critical juncture in this trial. Each juror has revolved his chair to face the witness stand. As Molto comes to the podium to begin the direct examination, the large courtroom is quiet.
State your name, please.
Raymond Patrick Horgan, he answers. The third. With that, he grins very briefly up at Laren. A private joke. I never knew that Raymond was a third. Amazing sometimes what comes out under oath. Molto again has readied himself with care for the examination. Raymond clearly knows what is coming, as he should, and he and Tommy develop a nice rhythm at once. Horgan's hands are folded. In his blue suit and finest public manner, he looks serene. All his beguiling charm is present, his candor. His gruff baritone is reduced one marking on the volume register in an effort at understatement. Tommy is taking his time. They are going to get everything they can from Horgan, recover quickly from yesterday's debacle in the War of Impressions. They cover Raymond's background, born right here, high school on the East End at St. Viator's. 2 years college, then his dad died. He became a cop. 7 years on the force, was already a sergeant when he graduated from Knight Law School. I'm afraid for a moment that Molto is going to bring out the fact that Raymond practiced law with Laren, but that is elided. Horgan simply says it was a three-man partnership, doing primarily criminal work. After 16 years in practice, politics.
Some elections I won, says Raymond. Some I lost.
With that, he turns to smile fondly at Nico at the prosecutor's table. DeLay rears his half-bald head from taking notes and beams back. My God, how they look at each other. The fastest friends. The jurors seem delighted by his alliance, forged on well-known past adversity. The smiling schoolteacher watches the unspoken exchange between the two with apparent delight. I feel my soul sinking. This will be a very hard day.
And do you know the defendant, Rojat Sabich?
I know Rusty, Raymond says.
Do you see him here in court?
I do.
Would you point to him and describe what he is wearing?
Next to Mr. Stern, second at the defense table, in a blue chalk-striped suit. This is a formality to establish that the Sabich spoken of is me. Yesterday with Eugenia, Sandy rose and agreed, stipulated is the term, to the identification so that we did not have to go through this exercise in finger-pointing. But now Stern quietly says to me, "Stand." I do. I rise slowly and face Raymond Horgan. I do not smile or grimace, but I am sure my abject fury is plain. Certainly Raymond's affability fades somewhat, even while his hand is in the air. "That's him," says Raymond quietly. Molto breezes through the history of my association with Raymond. Sandy will bring it out in detail anyway. Then he asks Raymond about Carolyn. Here Horgan becomes instantly somber. He lets his eyes fall to the rail of the witness box and says, "Yes, I knew her too."
"What was the nature of your relationship?"
"I met her first as a probation officer. For 8 years she was employed as a deputy prosecuting attorney in our office, and for a very brief time at the end of last year we had a personal relationship as well."
Nice. Succinct.
They move to the murder. Molto never mentions the election, but it emerges in Raymond's answers by reference.
"And is there any practice in the PA's office in supervising police investigations?"
"Certainly in a major case, and this was a very major case in my mind, there was a practice to assign a deputy PA to guide and assist the police."
"Who made the assignment in this case?"
"Well, to short-circuit things a little bit, I would say that Mr. Sabich and I decided that he should have that role in this case."
Tommy for the first time pauses. Raymond, it seems, may have backed down a little as a result of his meeting with Stern and me. Molto did not expect that. He asks again,
"How did Mr. Sabich get that assignment?"
"I don't really remember whether I suggested it or he did. Like everybody else, I was confused and upset at that time. He got the case. But he was glad to have it, I remember that. He was not reluctant at all and promised to pursue it vigorously."
"Did he?"
"Not to my way of thinking." This is objectionable as a conclusion, but Stern does not want to interrupt. One of his thick fingers has been laid from his chin to his nose, and he watches intently, not even bothering to take notes. At many times his concentration in court is trance-like. He shows very little. Just absorbs. I have the same sense that I did when we were in Horgan's office that Sandy's calculations are not about facts or strategy, but character. He is trying to figure Horgan out. Raymond registers his complaints with my handling of the case, including having to urge me to speed up the fingerprint and fiber reports. The impression comes through clearly that I was dogging it. Then he describes the conversation in his office that night we both first realized he was going to lose. "He asked me if I had been intimate with Carolyn."
"And what did you tell him?"
"The truth," says Raymond, quite simply. "No big deal. We'd been on for 3 months, then off."
"And when you told him this, did Mr. Sabich express surprise in any way?"
"None at all." "I get it. They're going to reason backward. I asked, but I knew anyway. What is their theory? That I was outraged when I found out? Or that I gave in to the weight of accumulated grievances? Neither one makes complete sense when you suppose, as Nico has, that my relationship with Carolyn was ongoing. Not having the right facts always hurts. I can feel many of the jurors watching me now, trying to read in me the truth of the prosecutor's surmise. And at any time in this conversation, or at any time earlier, did Mr. Savage inform you that he himself had a personal relationship with Ms. Polhemus?
Sandy is instantly back to life on his feet.
Objection. Your Honor, there is simply no proof of record of any personal relationship between Mr. Savage and Ms. Polhemus.
A good tactic, if for no other reason than to break the rhythm now and draw the jury back to yesterday. But this obstacle we are throwing up still presents a painful straddle for me. We cannot continue to make an issue of this failure of proof if I am going to get on the witness stand and tell the jury that everything Stern contested for 2 weeks is true, that Carolyn and I indeed had a warm romance. This is one of the many delicate means that Stern is employing seemingly to discourage my testimony.
Well, drawls Laren. He turns around in his chair. I would say almost no proof.
A nice comment for the defense.
I'm going to let the question stand, but I want to give the jury a limiting instruction. He faces them. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Molto is asking a question based on an assumption. It's up to you to decide, based on the evidence you hear in court, whether that assumption is true. Just because he says this doesn't make it so. Mr. Stern says there is not sufficient evidence to warrant that assumption, and at the end of the case, that will be one of the things for you to determine.
Proceed, Mr. Molto. Molto repeats the question.
Certainly not, says Raymond.
The Gaelic humor has now left his face.
Is that something you would have wanted to know?
Objection. Rephrase it, Mr. Molto. Is it something that the witness would have expected Mr. Savage to tell him, based on the witness's understanding of his office's practices?
It is rare for Laren to be so helpful to the prosecutors. I can see that Raymond is having the impact I long feared. When the question is put as the judge suggested, Raymond buries me.
I certainly did expect that. I never would have allowed him to handle that investigation. It raises more questions than it answers. The public should know that things are being done for professional, not personal reasons, he adds, a gratuitous shot.
Stern, in front of me, frowns.
Molto then takes Raymond to the end. The meeting in his office. Horgan faithfully recounts my outbursts in spite of Max and his warnings.
Describe Mr. Savage's appearance as he left the meeting.
You look quite excited, I would say. Very upset. He seemed to have completely lost his composure.
Molto looks at Nico, then says he has nothing further on direct.
Laren takes a recess before cross. In the John, as I come out of a stall, I find Delaguardia 2 sinks down. His hair is too thin now to comb. Instead, he tries to tickle it into place with his fingertips. His eyes flick a little bit when he notices me in the mirror.
Not a bad witness, huh?
He asks. His intent is hard to divine. I don't know if this is a casual aside or gloating. I keep getting the feeling that Nico is out of place emotionally. He is not oriented in this case, like offering me his hand on the day of the arraignment. He has never been the kind of person to make a frontal approach to unpleasantness, especially once someone has reached him. I remember when he divorced Diana. Even though she had been running around, he took her back into the apartment for a few weeks when she was thrown out by the other guy. Nico reads something in my hesitation.
I mean, you have to admit, he is not a bad witness.
I dry my hands. I realize now what it is. Nico still wants me to like him. God, human beings are strange. And maybe Nico even has his redeeming sign.
Horgan at this moment would be cold as a saber's edge.
It seems pointless at this little minute to resist him. I smile a bit. I use his nickname.
Better than Mrs. Kropotnik, Delay.
Now, Mr. Horgan, you mentioned that you had a personal relationship with Ms. Polhemus. Is that correct?
It is.
And you also told us that you believe Mr. Savage should have informed you that he had had such a relationship as well?
At a later time, says Raymond carefully. He wants to rule out jealousy on his part.
I felt when the investigation began he had a professional obligation to tell me.
Have you any personal knowledge, Mr. Horgan, that there was ever such a relationship between Mr. Savage and Ms. Polhemus?
That's the point, says Horgan. He never told me.
Sandy does not take getting stuck cheerfully. He looks at length toward Horgan. He wants the jury to notice that Raymond Horgan is taking shots. Please answer the question I asked you. Do you remember it?
I do.
But you chose not to answer it?
Raymond's mouth moves without words.
I apologize, Mr. Stern. I have no personal knowledge of such a relationship.
Thank you.
Sandy strolls.
But assuming there was something to reveal, you believe an honest official would make such disclosures to someone in a responsible position?
I do.
I see, says Stern.
He takes a moment to face Raymond. Sandy is short and soft, but in the courtroom he emits tremendous power. He is clearly equal to Raymond Horgan, who, too, is looking very firm. He sits there with his reddened Irish bulk, his hands folded, waiting for Sandy to take him on. Assuming that he comes out of this intact, Raymond's combination of prominence and skill is likely to make him the leading defense attorney in this city. His nearest rival will be the man who is examining him now. In the years ahead, there are no doubt going to be a number of multiple defendant cases in which they will sit together as co-counsel. In a very real sense, preservation of his relationship with Raymond is of far more practical importance for Stern than anything that happens to me. The rule of life in the defense bar ordinarily is to go along and get along. The state is the only professional enemy these guys want to have. Recognizing all of that, I have put my hostility aside and told Sandy that he has my blessings to treat Raymond gently. As Stern has pointed out before, Raymond's credibility, born of years in the public light, will make him hard to successfully assail in any event. But it is clear from Stern's demeanor that he will be neither courtly nor accommodating to Raymond. Perhaps Stern believes the direct was too damaging to simply absorb, but I am surprised that Sandy has begun any attack this abruptly. There are some favorable things Raymond will have to concede. Compliments on my performance in the office in the past, for example. The traditional wisdom is that you take what a witness will give you before you slap him.
And you applied these standards for disclosure to yourself as well?
I tried.
Certainly you would give all appropriate information to someone on your staff doing a job for you.
Again, Mr. Stern, I'd try.
And certainly the case concerning Miss Polhemus's death was a very important case in your office.
Given its political significance, I would call it critical.
Raymond looks in my direction as he says this. His eyes are hard as ball bearings.
But even though you yourself saw this as a critical case, you did not give Mr. Savage all the information at your disposal about the matter, or about Ms. Polhemus. Did you?
I tried.
Did you? Was it not very important to know everything Ms. Polhemus was working on, so that any person who might have a motive to do her harm could be identified?
Raymond suddenly sees where this is going. He sits back in his chair, but he still tries to fight.
That wasn't the only thing that was important.
Bad mistake. Lawyers really are lousy witnesses. Raymond is going to deny that Carolyn's docket was an important source of leads. Sandy embarrasses him badly in the next few moments. People in law enforcement often fear reprisals from those they prosecute. Such reprisals all too frequently occur. Law enforcement would be impossible if prosecutors and police could be assaulted, maimed, murdered by those they investigate. Certainly when Miss Polhemus was killed, it was thought, indeed it was speculated in the press, was it not, that a former defendant might have been her attacker? Raymond sees he's lost after a few questions and answers simply, yes.
So all of Ms. Polhemus's cases were important? It was important to know whom she was investigating, what she was looking into?
Yes.
And in spite of knowing that, Mr. Horgan, you personally removed a file from Ms. Polhemus's drawer after the investigation of her murder began, didn't you?
Yes.
A very sensitive matter, was it not?
Laren has observed the cross lying back in his chair. For the most part, he has appeared faintly amused by this contest between two well-known professionals. Now he interrupts. What's the relevance of this, counsel? Sandy, for a moment, is word-struck.
Your Honor, I think that the relevance of this is clear.
Not to me.
The witness has testified on direct examination that Mr. Savage did not bring to his attention information that Mr. Horgan regarded as pertinent. The defendant is entitled to explore Mr. Horgan's standards in this regard.
Mr. Horgan was the prosecuting attorney, Mr. Stern. You're mixing apples and oranges, says the judge.
Relief comes from an unexpected source. De La Guardia is on his feet.
We have no objection to this line of questioning, Judge.
Laren lets his glance linger in Nico's direction. Molto immediately grabs DeLay's forearm. I assume that Nico wants the discussion about professional standards to continue in the belief that it will further educate the jury about the extent of my deviation. But he is well out of place here. For one thing, Horgan is not his witness. And I take it from the heated way that Molto speaks to him as DeLay resumes his seat that Nico does not recognize the drift of Sandy's questioning. I wonder if he even knows about the B-file, or has just forgotten. I make a note which I will give to Stern at the break. Who did Horgan tell Ray B-file? Molto? Nico? Neither? With new daylight, Sandy quickly proceeds.
As I said, this was a very sensitive matter, was it not?
Yes.
It involved allegations.
Laren again injects himself, more faithful than a Labrador. We don't need the details of the internal workings of the prosecuting attorney's office or of its investigations, many of which, I remind you, Mr. Stern, are protected by rules of grand jury secrecy. This was a sensitive case. Let us move on.
Of course, Your Honor. I had no interest in disclosing any secrets.
Of course not, says Laren. He smiles with apparent disbelief and turns toward his water carafe, which, it so happens, is in the direction of the jury. Proceed.
And, in fact, this case was so sensitive, Mr. Horgan, that you assigned it to Ms. Polhemus without informing any other person in your office that you had done so. Yes?
Yes. Sandy quickly lists everyone in the office who was not told. Mac, the Special Investigations Chief Mike Dolan, three or four more names. He ends with me. Raymond acknowledges each.
And you gave the file to Mr. Savage only when he personally informed you that a file appeared to be missing from Ms. Polhemus's office. Is that not true?
True. Sandy takes a little tour around the courtroom to let all of this sink in. Raymond has been tarnished. The jury is paying close attention.
Now, Miss Polhemus was an ambitious woman, was she not?
I suppose it depends on what you mean by ambitious. She enjoyed being in the public eye. She wanted to progress in your office, did she not?
All true.
She wanted to handle this case?
As I recall.
Now, Mr. Horgan, you assigned this case to Miss Polhemus, this highly sensitive matter, to her, this case that only you and she knew about, this case she was eager to handle while you two were personally involved. Correct?
Raymond begins to roll again in his seat. He knows that Stern will spare him nothing now. He has hunkered down a little so that, to my eye, it looks as if he is trying to duck.
I really don't recall exactly when I made that assignment.
Let me remind you, then.
Sandy gets the file jacket, shows Raymond the docketing date, reminds him of his direct testimony about when he and Carolyn were dating.
So, he concludes, you assigned this very sensitive case to Ms. Polhemus while you were personally involved with her.
That appears to be when it happened.
Stern stands still and looks at Horgan.
The answer to the question, says Raymond, is yes.
Your failure to inform anyone of this assignment contradicted established procedure in your office, did it not?
I was the prosecuting attorney. I decided when there would be exceptions to the rules.
He has picked up Laren's hint. And you made an exception for Ms. Polhemus?
Yes. With whom you were...
Strike that. Ordinarily such a case would have been assigned to a lawyer with more experience in such matters, would it not?
That's a consideration, ordinarily.
But that wasn't a consideration here?
No.
And this remained your secret with Ms. Polhemus, did it not, even after your relationship with her ended?
True, says Raymond. He smiles for the first time in a while. There was no change in my conduct.
Because you were embarrassed?
It didn't occur to me.
And when Mr. Savage was trying to assemble all the information in the office about Ms. Polhemus's cases, it did not occur to you that you had gone to her office and put the file in your drawer?
I suppose it didn't.
You were not attempting to conceal anything, were you, Mr. Horgan?
I was not.
There was an election campaign taking place, was there not?
Yes.
A tough campaign?
Brutal.
A campaign in which, as it turned out, you were losing?
Yes.
A campaign in which your opponent, Mr. De La Guardia, had been a deputy in your very office and had many friends there?
That's true.
And you were not concerned, Mr. Horgan, in the midst of this brutal campaign, about word leaking out through one of Mr. De La Guardia's friends, that you had given choice assignments to an assistant with whom you were sleeping?
Maybe it crossed my mind. Who knows, Mr. Stern? It was not an ideal situation.
Far from it, says Stern. I ask you again, sir. Were you not trying to hide the fact that you had had an affair with a member of your staff?
It wasn't something I ordinarily talked about, if that's what you mean.
No, indeed. It could be viewed as unprofessional.
It could be, but it wasn't. We were both adults.
I see. You had confidence in your judgment, notwithstanding this affair.
Very much so.
Stern has gradually approached Horgan. Now he takes the last few steps and reaches out to touch the rail of the witness stand, so that he stands only a few feet from Raymond. And yet, sir, you come to this courtroom where the life of a man who served you faithfully for a dozen years now hangs in the balance, and you tell us that you would have none of the same confidence in him?
Horgan's look locks with Stern's. From where I am, I cannot quite see Raymond's expression. He finally faces about, and when he does, he has his tongue tucked into his cheek. He is looking now in De La Guardia's direction, somewhat sheepishly. I am not sure if he is seeking help or casting apologies.
I wish he had said something, that's all. It would have looked better for him. It would have looked better for me.
One of the jurors says, I hear the sound, but do not see whom it came from. Others are looking toward the floor. It is hard to figure why this seems to have such an impact. Nothing has changed the fingerprints, or the fibers, or the records from my phone. But it has been a splendid moment for the defense. Molto and Nico have brought Raymond Horgan to this courtroom as the model of propriety, the arbiter of standards. Now it turns out that things have been overblown. Just as he did in representing Colleen McGaffin, Sandy Stern has found the message to this jury that he wishes to send, but never speak aloud. So what, he is saying. Suppose it is true that Savage and the decedent had been intimate. Suppose that he chose, wisely or not, to keep that to himself. It is still no different from what Horgan did. If I was too embarrassed to confess aspects of my past conduct, everyone should understand. The knot between what I did not say and what I did has been untied. The juncture has been severed between murder and deceit. Sandy walks away. He lets Horgan sit. Raymond sighs a couple of times and removes his handkerchief. As Stern paces by our table, he places his hand on my shoulder, and I cover it with mine.
a spontaneous gesture, but it seems to go down well with one or two jurors who notice.
Let us turn to another subject, Mr. Horgan. How did you meet Mr. Savage?
Sandy is still strolling, headed back now toward the witness, and below the table I motion to him, no, I forgot to tell him not to ask that question.
Perhaps we should not loiter with ancient history, says Stern casually. I shall withdraw that question, if the court please. As a matter of fact, Your Honor, if this would be a convenient point, perhaps we could all do with some lunch.
Very well, says Laren. He seems particularly sober after Raymond's performance. Before he leaves the bench, Judge Little glances back at Horgan, who has still not moved. Chapter 29.
So what did you think of this morning,
asks Stern. He reaches for the relish tray.
You must try the corn willy, Rusty. Such a simple dish, but really very well prepared.
Stern has worked through lunch each day preceding, but you can tell that it is not his chosen routine. A civilized life includes a meal at noontime, he would say, and today, Horgan or not, he takes me to his dining club for lunch. It is on the 46th floor of Morgan Towers, one of the tallest buildings in town. From here you can see the river bend and sway, the serried ranks of the city skyline, which these days looks mostly like so many shoeboxes end on end. If you had a telescope, you could probably make out my home and nearing.
I would have expected to become closer to Sandy. I am fond of him, and my respect for his professional abilities, never slight, has grown progressively. But I would not say that we have become friends. Perhaps it is because I'm a client, charged with murder, no less. But Stern's view of human capacity is itself large enough that I doubt any one act, no matter how heinous, would disqualify someone from his affections. The problem, if there is a problem, is the man and his inner restraints. He draws his lines in his professional life, and I doubt anyone passes. He has been married 30 years. I have met Clara once or twice. Their three children are now spread all around the country. The youngest, a daughter, will finish at Columbia Law School next year. But as I think about it, I do not know many other people who claim to be close to Stern. He is a pleasant companion on any social occasion, and he is a polished raconteur. I remember that a friend of Barbara's father told me years ago that Stern tells marvelous stories in Yiddish, a skill I, of course, cannot confirm, but there are sharp limits on Sandy Stern's sense of intimacy. I know very little of what he really thinks, particularly about me.
I have two comments about this morning, I say, as I help myself to corn. I thought it went very well, and I enjoyed it a great deal. The cross has been brilliant.
Oh, well, says Stern.
Sandy, despite his fine manners, is a considerable egotist, like every other noted trial lawyer. He shakes his head, but then takes a moment to savor my praise. A number of the reporters and courtroom observers whispered their compliments as we were on the way over here. Stern, only halfway through the cross, still wears the light air of triumph.
He did it to himself, really. I do not think I recognized before the start of this case how vain a person Raymond is. Even so, I do not know how far it takes us.
You embarrassed him very badly.
Apparently. He is bound to remind me of it some day.
But that is not our problem now.
I was surprised Laren was so protective of Raymond. If I had to guess, I would have bet that he'd have bent over backward to appear neutral. Laren has never been afraid of being regarded as a man with his own affinities.
Sandy sits back as a waiter sets down his plate.
Well, says Stern, I only hope we do as well at the next critical juncture. I am not as optimistic.
I do not understand what he is talking about.
There are two pivotal cross-examinations in this trial, Rusty, he says. We are only in the midst of the first.
What's the other? LaPrancer?
No,
Stern frowns a bit, unhappy apparently merely with the prospect of Lip's testimony.
Detective LaPrancer for us will be primarily a holding action. In that case, we will be hoping merely to ease the sting.
No, I was thinking of Dr. Kumagai.
Kumagai?
Oh, yes. Sandy nods to himself.
You see, of course, that the physical evidence is the center of the prosecutor's case. But in order to fully utilize that evidence, Nico must call a scientific expert. Delaguardia cannot stand before the jury at the end of the case and offer only conjecture on how this act took place. His theories must be buttressed by a scientist's opinions. So, he will call Kumagai. Sandy samples his lunch with obvious appreciation.
Forgive me for being didactic. I am unaccustomed to counseling trial lawyers. At any rate, Kumagai's testimony becomes critical. If he performs well, he will solidify the prosecution case. But his testimony also offers an opportunity for us. It is really the only chance we will have to blunt the edge somewhat on the physical evidence, the fingerprints, the fibers, all of these items that are normally unassailable. If we make Kumagai look dubious, the physical evidence, all of it, suffers as well.
And how do you do that?
Ah, says Stern somewhat wistfully, you ask all the difficult questions. We must turn our attention to that shortly.
He taps his bread knife and casts his eyes toward the skyline, not really focused on it.
Kumagai is not a pleasant individual. A jury will not warm to him. Something will suggest itself.
In the meantime, Stern says, looking back to me abruptly, what was this blunder I almost made? Something awful would have been disclosed when I asked how you and Horgan met? I didn't think you wanted the jury to hear about how the Yugoslavian freedom fighter went to federal prison.
Your father? Oh, dear. Rusty, I must apologize to you for that improvisation the other day. It came to me as I was there. You understand these things, I'm sure.
I tell Sandy that I understand.
Your father went to jail. How did that happen? Horgan represented him?
Steve Mulcahy. Raymond just covered a couple of the court calls. That was how we met. He was very nice to me. I was quite upset.
Mulcahy was the other partner?
In those days it was Mulcahy, Little, and Horgan.
He has been dead many years. We are talking about some time ago, I take it.
I was still in law school. Mulcahy was my professor. When my father got the first summons, I went to him. I was terribly embarrassed. I thought character and fitness might keep me out.
Of the bar? My lord. What was the crime?
Taxes, I say. I take the first bit of my lunch. My father didn't file for 25 years.
25 years? Oh, my. How is your fish?
Good. Would you care for a little?
If you don't mind. Thank you. You're much too kind. They really do this very well here.
Sandy chats on. He is serene and comfortable amid the silver plate table settings and the waiters in pastel cutaway coats. His retreat. In 45 minutes, he will resume cross-examining one of the most prominent lawyers in the city. But, like all virtuosos, he has a well-deserved faith in his instincts. He has worked hard. The rest is inspiration. When the meal is near its end, I show Sandy the notes I made this morning.
Oh, yes, he tells me, very good.
Some matters he is determined not even to respond to. You are falsely accused, and he says you seem to lack composure? Really, this is too silly to repeat. At another table he sees a friend, an older red-haired man. Sandy departs for a second to greet him. I review the pad I have brought along from the courthouse, but most of it has been covered in our discussion. Instead, I look out toward the city, and as usual think about my father with despair. I had been wildly angry with him throughout that episode, both because of my own discomfiture and because I felt he had no right to seek attention after ignoring my mother's illness then in its initial stages. But as I watched my father in Mulcahy's outer office, a worm of pain began to eat at my heart. In his distraction, my father, usually rigid about his personal hygiene, had failed to shave. His beard grew quickly and his cheeks were whitish with the stubble. He held the felt brim of his hat in his fingers and turned it in his hands. He had a tie on, which he seldom wore,
The knot was a kind of crumbled mess pulled off to the side, and his shirt was soiled around the collar. He did not seem to fill his chair or even his clothing. He looked at his feet on the floor. He appeared much older than he was, and terribly afraid. I do not believe I had ever seen my father visibly frightened before that. His almost invariable mien was of a rough-tempered, sullen indifference. I did not wonder what produced the change. My father seldom spoke to me about his history. Virtually everything I knew came from his relatives. The shooting of his parents, my father's flight, the camps of one side or the other where my father passed the last years of his youth. They ate a horse, my cousin Ilya told me once when I was 9 or 10. The story inspired nightmares for most of a week. An old nag had died. It keeled over in the night and froze. It lay in the snow for 3 days, and then some guard allowed it to be dragged beyond the barbed wire fence of the compound. The inmates attacked it. They pulled off the hide with their bare hands and grabbed at the flesh. Some meant only to take something to cook, but others, in their panic, began to eat it there. My father had seen that. He came to America. He had survived. And now, in a lawyer's office, almost 3 decades later, he could foresee a repetition. I was 25 years old, and I understood more of my father's life then, and how his deprivations in that odd heredity of material effects had become my own. I recognized more of that in a moment than in all the time before. And I was overcome by grief. Mulcahy pled my father guilty. The assistant U.S. attorney promised